Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised. Please take care of yourself.
Welcome to Fruit Loops, episode 227.
Yeah.
Buiti binafi, bienvenidos bitches, and thank you so much for listening. Now, Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and those who are othered and the victims, because we are all capable of doing very terrible things, and all victims deserve to have their stories told.
Yeah. And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy, a Black Latinx woman. And I'm Beth, and I just happen to be white, and it's just part of who
it's
we are.
It's just part of who we are. Yeah. It's actually the least interesting thing about
us. Yes, true.
Yeah.
We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists, just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions.
All right, my friend, so who are we talking about today?
Today, we're talking about Lloyd Gomez, a.k.a. the Phantom Hobo Killer,
oh.
A Native American slash Latinx serial killer who murdered 9 men experiencing homelessness across California between 1950 and 1951.
All right, so before we get into it, how you doing?
Well, I've been pretty stressed out this past week.
Yeah.
Yeah. Work stuff, family stuff, yeah. It's all coming down, but getting through it, and I'm feeling better today.
Good. Yeah. My friend, I am relieved to hear you say that, and I know you're not all the way through it. You're hanging in.
Yes.
But you're hanging in there.
I'm hanging. I'm feeling much better today than I did yesterday. I'll say that.
Good. Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's good to hear. Yeah. The prayers are working! Well, good. I'm very glad to hear it. And I'm glad you're here.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. The kids are on a spring break.
Ooh.
And I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, like spring break, we would do nothing.
Yeah.
I would stay home. I always had homework, maybe get a doctor's or dentist appointment in, but I never went anywhere.
Yeah, we played outside.
Today,
yeah.
Exactly. And watched my programs.
Right.
These kids today are like, where are we going?
Uh-huh.
How many stars is the hotel?
No.
Like, what the fuck? Who are you? Anyway.
They're bougie.
They are bougie. And I can't like just take time off. I mean, I knew spring break was coming, but I'm just so swamped with work and stuff. So I was like, you guys go enjoy yourselves. So they're all at the beach.
Nice.
Somewhere in Alabama having a gay old time.
Wow.
I miss them, but it's been really nice to have the house to myself.
I bet.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So let us know how you're doing. Now we're going to go into the listener letter.
All right. Well, hello, angels. Thank you. I wanted to say thank you to Lash123 for your 5-star review.
Thank you so much, Hip Hop Air Horns.
Yeah. And that's it. That's all I got.
Okay. So,
but I did want to say, if you have any questions or comments, please send them to FruitLoopsPod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at
602-935-6294.
And we may feature it on a future episode. But if you don't want us to, just let us know and we won't. It's as simple as that.
Also, I just want to say, we see all the messages. We get all the voicemails and all the emails, everything. We see it all. And I don't want anybody out there to think we're ignoring you or not responding, but we see everything and we appreciate you getting at us with your thoughts and comments and suggestions, all the things. We love you all so much.
Thank you so much.
We got a new Patreon,
woo-hoo!
Andrea H. And I'm just going to give Andrea a quick hip hop air horn.
Right on.
And here is your personalized shout out. Oh, whoa, whoa. They say you love the show. Thank you, Andrea. Yeah. Oh, she's a bona fide fruity. A go, 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 Andrea. Whoa. And that's for you. Thank you so much for joining our Patreon.
Yeah, thanks, Andrea.
Just a reminder, we do meetups, virtual ones, of course, because I'm not leaving my house, but virtual meetups and bonus content, ad-free. We do the news every week, so you get access to that as well, true crime news. And we have a wonderful Patreon community, so join
us. We do. Yeah, thank you.
So now we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to get into the story when we come back. Hey, Beth.
Yeah.
What's something besides true crime that you and I both love?
Movies?
Yes.
Bing, bing, bing. I win.
Did you catch my Jeff Goldblum impression?
Yeah.
Yes. And Beth and I have seen many together. Oh, yes. And my favorite part about going to a movie is the magic of it all. The popcorn, the snacks, the drinks, the comfy seats, and just taking it in and getting lost in the screen and the sound. Beth, what made you fall in love with movies?
I just love getting lost in the stories.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can try to capture that at home, but you can't. You can't.
Not exactly the same.
No. There's always something that interrupts the flow. You got to pause. You got to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I love going to the movies so much that I go back to see the same ones in theaters, sometimes more than once.
Oh, girl.
Yeah. And in fact, I just saw Dune 2 again with my grown kids for my birthday.
Again?
Yeah.
But also, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Also, that's right. We at Fruit Loops, we don't play about our movies. Beth doesn't play. I don't play. So if you don't play about your movie going experience and like going to the theater, then Regal Unlimited just makes sense.
Yeah, Regal Unlimited is an all-you-can-watch movie subscription pass that pays for itself in just 2 visits.
Pays for itself? What? Who? How?
So you can see any standard 2D movie anytime with no blackout dates or restrictions. And then if you want to see a movie in a premium format like 4DX, IMAX, RPX, or ScreenX, your Regal Unlimited membership gets you into those premium experiences at a reduced cost.
Oh, yeah. I see. Oh, wow. And with Regal Unlimited, you won't just save money on tickets. You will also save on the most important part, folks, snacks.
Woo.
The snacks. That's right. Members get 10% off on all non-alcoholic concession items.
You can't see a movie without popcorn. You just
absolutely
can't.
Not.
No.
Nope. Mm-mm.
So if you're planning to see 2 movies this month, you need to join Regal Unlimited. Sign up now in the Regal app or on Reg Movies. That's REGMovies.com/unlimited. Use promo code FLOOPSREG, that's FLOOPSREG, to let them know that Beth and Wendy sent you.
Again, go to the Regal app or on REGMovies.com/unlimited and use promo code FLOOPSREG.
Yeah, let them know we sent you, and thanks Regal Cinemas for sponsoring the show.
Okay, so we're back. Remind us, Beth, who is our subject today?
Our subject today is Lloyd Gomez, who killed 9 men over a period of 15 months. Most of the victims were beaten to death. One was shot.
All right. Now we're going to get into the love and light section of our show, where we just say love and light to the communities, loved ones, family members, anybody left in the wake of these horrible murders. And we also want to say rest in paradise to the victims. The names are John Doe, who was about 50 years old, Warren Hood Cunningham, 42, Roy Chester Hansen, 46, George Jones, 69, Elmer Cushman, age unknown, another John Doe, age unknown, Arvid B. Ostlund, 40 years old, and another John Doe, age unknown. And Earl Franklin Woods was 50 years old. So rest in power to those men. Now we're going to get into the setting. Take us there, Beth.
Well, the setting is California in the 1950s. People have lived in what's now California and Baja California in Mexico for almost 20,000 years. Because the landscape has so many different habitats, the rainy redwood forests, the snow-capped Sierra Nevada mountains, the Central Valley farmlands, the Mojave Desert, and the Pacific Ocean coastline. It's a really big place.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I'll never forget the California project I made out of papier-mâché in the second grade.
So the ancient people who settled there split into more than 500 tribes, each developing their own culture and lifestyle.
And just some of the tribes' names, there are many. And if you get the opportunity to look into the history and present of some of these tribes, you should. They are the Pomo, Miwok, Maidu, Chumash, Tolawa, Kawiya, Kahota, and Wintun.
Europeans' contact with California began in the 1530s when Spanish conquistador Cortez and his men ventured into Baja California. In 1542, Spaniards sailed north to what they called Alta California. I understand that means Upper California?
Higher.
Okay. Okay. And Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo's expedition that year made landings as far north as modern Santa Barbara.
Santa Barbara! Isn't that the soap opera theme song?
Am I
just making that up? I used to watch that with my
soap opera.
Cruz is innocent. I used to watch it when I was a kid and just repeat things that I didn't know what they meant. Anyway, back to the story. So the coastal winds and currents made the voyage for these Spaniard conquistadors very difficult, and the area was not colonized until the 1700s. And it was not until the Seven Years' War from 1756 to 1763 that Spain seriously attempted to assert control over Alta California.
Small towns or pueblos sprang up. The earliest of these were associated with the missions and presidios, but in 1777, an independent civil pueblo was created at San Jose, and others soon followed. The pueblos tried to attract settlers with land grants and other inducements.
Okay. There are people who already lived there.
Yes.
In 1808, one by one, Spain's American colonies began to fight for independence. In 1821, Mexico achieved her independence, and word of this event reached Alta California the following year. As British, Canadian, and United States settlers moved to Oregon, they also began an encroachment of non-Mexicans in Northern California across the border. And by the way, this is not without resistance. I hope that goes without saying that the people who were there were fighting.
They were like, what the fuck?
So I just don't want that to not be said.
Right. There were a few permanent residents of non-Hispanic birth or descent before 1824, but their numbers increased steadily in the Mexican era. And when gold was discovered in 1848 in Coloma, California, thousands of white settlers rushed into California.
In the next year, close to 100,000 people went to California from the United States, Europe, and every other corner of the globe. In 1849, approximately 40,000 people poured in from one sea route or another. Most of these came through the port of San Francisco.
San Francisco. Na 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 no more.
You're just a walking musical.
I don't know what it is. And maybe it's now that my kids aren't here, I have something to sing
you
about.
You can do whatever. You can do whatever you want.
Exactly. Yeah.
So not only were they coming from the sea, but they were coming overland too. And 25 to 30,000 men, women, and children came overland across the plains and through one of the mountain passes on California's eastern border.
Many who came to California to mine gold found that business and farming in California were better sources of income. The first federal census conducted in California in 1860 counted 308,000 residents, which is so crazy to think of, because isn't it like the largest
billions,
state?
That's
wow. The population had almost tripled since 1847. And that's those are the people that were counted in the census. I don't know if enslaved people were counted. I do not know if indigenous people were counted, but my impression is they weren't. So,
yeah, it looks like 39 million people.
Wow.
Now, currently.
Wow. Yep. Wow.
Yeah.
Insanity.
The Spanish, Mexicans, and mission fathers had confined their activities to the coast, and the Native American tribes and clans inland had suffered comparatively little by contact with Europeans. However, the gold rush took prospectors and peddlers into the areas where Native Americans had earlier lived in peace.
They then suffered not only from the spread of disease and violence at the hands of prospectors and settlers, but also from the white Americans' greed for land, right? The indigenous people didn't look at the land as something that
belonging.
A person could own. Yeah, it's here for all of us, right? Am I right, guys? Up high.
Mm-hmm.
And the white Americans were like, no. And the natives were not even safe on reservations set aside for them by the government.
If white people wanted the lands for gold mining or other purposes, the tribes found themselves shunted to even more desolate reservations. And every year, the expanding network of railroads brought even more white people.
In 1846, some 11,500 of California's 14,000 non-indigenous residents were of Spanish or Mexican descent. By 1850, Spanish-speaking Californians were only 15% of the non-native population. And by 1870, only 4%.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
In January 1863, work began on the Central Pacific Line that was to run east from Sacramento and link California with the east. That's a railroad line.
Mm-hmm.
On May 10th, 1869, at Promontory Point, Utah, it joined its sister road extending from the east, the Union Pacific.
And my understanding, this needs further fact-checking, but that the railroads were built by Asian immigrants.
Yes. Yeah, we could tell a whole thing about that.
Yeah. Episode. Yeah. Maybe we will someday.
We did talk about it in one episode.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure we've
but
we
there's
it up.
Plenty
there's
more
so
we
much,
could talk about.
So much, yeah. So much, so much,
so much. Yeah.
With the coming of railroads and development of the southern region, Californians of Mexican background ceased to matter to those who had taken power. Only when their numbers were reinforced by new immigration in the 20th century would they again be a force in California's politics and culture.
During the time that today's story takes place, many of the larger cities in California had encampments of people called hobos. The term hobo emerged in the American West about 1890, but its origins are unclear. It often carries a negative connotation, but was a word frequently used during this time.
Hobos, as they were described at that time, were migratory workers who helped satisfy America's labor needs starting after the Civil War. Because, side note, there was all this work to do and no longer people to do it for free.
Yeah.
And that was a big problem for the United States.
Right.
So many of them were hobos by choice. And I'm going to... Did we use that word much longer? It feels weird to say.
Hobos?
Yeah.
Yeah. We use the word hobos because that's the word that was used back then.
At the time and in all the sources. I understand.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we'll talk about it a little bit.
Okay. Yeah. So many of them were quote unquote hobos by choice. They worked to travel and traveled to work. These people became sort of folk heroes because of what was interpreted as their carefree lifestyles and away from society's restrictions. Which, when you put it like that, it does sound pretty dope.
It does sound pretty good. Yeah. Yeah. And there were people who that's what they wanted to do. So, and they actually did not mind the word hobo.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
So
thank you. Yeah.
You're welcome. So their chief mode of transportation was freight trains. I'm sure you've heard about people hopping trains.
Yeah. Yeah. I believe that you said one of your relatives
died hopping a train. Yeah.
Yeah.
My uncle, my dad's brother.
Oh, my gosh.
He fell when he was hopping a train and got ran over by the train.
I'm sorry, Beth. I'm sorry to bring it up. Why did I do that?
Oh, no. I never knew him. This happened before I was born.
Oh,
so,
okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's still tragic. And I bet you it happened. It's not definitely not safe to play around trains.
No, it's not. So they were common throughout the United States from the late 1800s to the mid 1900s.
Okay.
And the hobo population exploded during the Great Depression of the 1930s as thousands of unemployed people rode the rails in search of work.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting at all these periods of time in history when there's lack, the ingenuity of people to get to where they need to get to and get what they need for the most part. But this is also, you know, when there's intense poverty, increase in crime as well. Yeah. Which
you gotta figure out how to take care of yourself and feed yourself, and you know, the ingenuity,
yes,
is amazing.
Yes, yeah, yes. So a hobo camp, aka jungle, typically refers to a makeshift settlement where these people lived, often out of necessity. Hobo camps became little communities with shelter, food, and alcohol shared between the folks that lived there. These campsites were usually outside city limits, near railroad tracks or rail yards, or near a river, lake, or pond if possible. Gotta have water.
Yeah, and they were probably outside city limits to get away from the popo.
Right, because, spoiler alert, poverty has been criminalized throughout history since the beginning of time.
Yep. And we're just about to get into that.
Okay.
So from the colonial era to the 21st century, vagrants, individuals who could be convicted of the crime of vagrancy, have been labeled legally and colloquially as wanderers, vagabonds, beggars, tramps, and hobos.
So vagrancy generally is defined as the act of continuous geographical movement by the poor and people of color. Often has been interpreted to signify idleness, unemployment, and homelessness. Vagrancy laws in the U.S. developed as a way to repress progress and perceived threats to society, i.e. white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy. And this was especially true. Vagrancy laws shot through the roof after
the Civil War.
Yeah. People of African ancestry were free from enslavement. And
so basically it was illegal to just be walking around.
Just, yep. And not have a job. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Illegal to not have a job.
Crazy.
It's nuts.
Yeah.
Just thinking about that is nuts.
Yeah.
The history of vagrancy laws in the United States has deep roots originating in 16th century England and subsequently making their way to the New World with the colonists. These laws proliferated throughout the British colonies and later became part of the legal landscape in the United States.
Here we are.
Yep.
Just more little peeling back the curtain. In England, vagrancy laws were designed to regulate and control the behavior of those who did not own property and had no visible means of support. These laws were transplanted to the American colonies and served as a way to penalize movement by lower classes. They targeted individuals deemed, quote unquote, out of place or undesirable in society.
Vagrancy laws took various forms, generally criminalizing behaviors such as being poor.
Oh, yep.
Idle, immoral, drunk, lewd, or suspicious. Mm. Yeah, you're going to get arrested for being suspicious.
Sus. So sus.
Some laws specifically prohibited loitering, wandering around without any apparent lawful purpose. These laws served as a tool to maintain social hierarchy and order.
Yeah, but order and hierarchy according to whom?
Yeah, right.
Over time, vagrancy laws were applied to different groups based on perceived threats to social fabric. Targets included the unemployed labor activists, radical orators, cultural and sexual nonconformists, racial and religious minorities, civil rights protesters, and the poor. People experiencing homelessness and ethnic minorities were especially vulnerable to arrest as a vagrant.
That sucks.
Yeah, and it's still true today.
Vagrancy laws, virtually unquestioned for four centuries, ultimately unraveled due to changing social attitudes and legal challenges. The 1960s brought profound social upheaval, leading to the concerted efforts against the vagrancy regime. In 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court invalidated vagrancy laws, making a significant shift.
Yes, invalidated and called it something else.
Yeah.
So what are they? Public nuisance. Trespassing. Right. Take your pick.
Yeah.
Local authorities have since sought alternative ways to address the functions once served by these laws, such as criminalizing panhandling and restricting public areas in which sitting or sleeping are allowed. So now let's get into the early life of Lloyd Gomez.
Lloyd Gomez was born on December 6, 1923 in Caliente, Nevada, the son of a Shoshone Native American woman and a Mexican father. His mother died when he was young. His father, Manuel, was a strong influence on him during his early years, but not a good one.
Uh-oh.
He was often in trouble with the law.
In 1939, when he was 15 or 16, Lloyd left his home in Lincoln County, Nevada, to explore California by riding freight cars. Ride the rails! With a fourth grade education and an IQ of 61, Lloyd was described by some as having the mind of a child.
Between 1939 and 1941, he was arrested several times for minor offenses, including vagrancy, for which he served a 30-day jail sentence. At one point, he was deported to Mexico, despite the fact that he was born in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. What the fuck?
He's brown. Send him to Mexico.
Yeah, that's basically what they're saying.
That's terrible. That's terrible.
Yeah, it's awful. Mm. So when he wasn't in prison or in jail, Lloyd worked as an itinerant farm worker, picking fruit or vegetable crops when in season. In between those seasons, his nomadic lifestyle, riding freight cars up and down California, labeled him a hobo. He bought food if he had money, stole some if he didn't. In other words, he was basically just surviving.
Yeah.
And also, I should say, he was just surviving, and the people within that community or cast of folks ride the rails and seek employment and all those things, they also were basically just trying to survive.
Yep.
Hi, I'm Sean McCabe.
And I'm Carrie McCabe.
We are, well, married, obviously, but we're also obsessed with the darker side of things.
True crime stories, alien abductions, poltergeists. If it leaves you scratching your head and keeping those lights on at night, we want to hear about it.
That's why we host the podcast, Ain't It Scary, with Sean and Carrie.
Every week, we bring our listeners a true story guaranteed to send chills down your spine, from history's most brutal serial killers to the mystery of spontaneous human combustion.
Yep, lots of these stories leave unanswered questions behind, and you'll get to poke through the rubble of the evidence with a hardened skeptic and
someone whose mind is more open to fun.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
You can find Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie wherever you get your podcasts, and on social media at Ain't It Scary. Come play with us.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes. I've traced heroic acts of bravery, and I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.
So now we're going to get into the timeline.
In March of 1942, when he was 18, Gomez was arrested for attempted robbery after he threatened the life of a man named Bruce Olson and took his guns and ammunition. He was sentenced to serve 2.5 to 20 years in the Nevada State Penitentiary.
Quite a gap.
Yeah, that's
2 to 20.
That's crazy.
Yeah, the math ain't mathing on that one. So 19 months later, Gomez was joined in prison by his father, Manuel Gomez. You hate to see it. I mean, Maury Povich, Oprah, so many reunion, father-son reunions. And prison is my least favorite one.
Least favorite, yeah.
My least favorite place for family to reunite. So his father had received a life sentence for murder after he killed a man named Jesus Garcia in Carlin, Nevada on New Year's Day in 1943.
Gomez Sr. and Garcia were part of a railroad crew working in Carlin, a small town 23 miles west of Elko. Witnesses told deputies they saw Gomez beating Garcia over the head with a pickaxe handle.
Oh my God.
But they did not know any of the details that led to the fight.
Gomez Sr. claimed he killed Garcia in self-defense after Garcia tried to stab him with a butcher's knife. But he was found guilty of first-degree murder. However, instead of recommending to the judge that he should die in Nevada's famous gas chamber, the first in the country, innovation, they recommended a life sentence.
And in early December, father and son were reunited in prison.
Reunited, and it feels inappropriate.
But after serving 4 years on the attempted robbery charge in May of 1946, Gomez Jr. was released from prison due to overcrowding.
On January 12th, 1947, Gomez broke into the American Can Company's Sacramento warehouse and was caught by the night watchman breaking into a candy vending machine. After he was booked by police, Gomez admitted to multiple other burglaries.
Gomez was sentenced to 7 months in the Sacramento County Road Camp. What is a county road camp?
Tell us!
Well, let me tell you. During the early 20th century, prisoners in California worked in different forms of labor as a method of rehabilitation through work. In particular, road work, building and maintaining roads, emerged as a popular form of convict labor. So popular.
Wow. Look at us innovating, creating new exciting forms of convict labor. Wow, America. How do you do it? Anyway, so prison road camps were promoted as a path for prisoners to reintegrate with society by instilling a work ethic and personal responsibility. That's not always why people get into crime in prison in the first place, but okay. In road camps, they were paid more and the conditions were safer than in other forms of labor offered to them.
Yeah, so I was reading, like sometimes they would have to work in mills where the air was bad and stuff like that. So this was actually a preferred sentence.
Yeah,
even though,
in terms of harm, this was the least harmful.
The least harmful, yeah.
So at the same time, the state benefited using the road camps to develop highways and expanding the state economy by saving money. Just it is just slavery.
Just
reincarnated. Yeah. A little bit different.
A little bit different, yeah. Gomez was released, but in May of 1948, he was convicted of assault and sent back to the road camp to serve a 60-day sentence. For some reason, he walked away from the road crew a few weeks before his time was up.
What?
Yeah. I mean, they actually weren't, like, imprisoned. So, I mean, they could leave
they
at
could.
Any time.
Okay, okay.
But... you know, it's not advised.
No.
Not advisable.
I mean, somebody's going to find out. Yeah. They're going to know. They're going to know.
They're going to know.
Yeah, they're going to know. So that July, the same time he would have completed his road crew sentence, he was arrested in Las Vegas for counterfeiting and sentenced to serve 1 year and 1 day at the McNeil Island Federal Prison Penitentiary. It's a prison penitentiary. That is.
Oh, look at that.
Double time.
Double prison.
Double prison. Wow. In Washington State. Can I get a supersized prison experience?
He got one.
He got one. A prison penitentiary. I've never seen that before.
Yeah. I don't know.
Wow.
I don't know if that's correct.
I love it, though.
It was after his release from McNeil Island in July of 1949 that Gomez started on his murder spree. The first murder happened near Oroville in Butte County, California, during the summer of 1950.
A middle-aged Native American man invited Gomez to share a bottle of wine in his shack near the railroad tracks. As Gomez followed the man to his shack, he picked up a rock and bashed the man in the head with it. He struck him 6 more times, then walked away with 5 cents.
Yeah, and I did a conversion of that. It's like 61 cents today, so it's still not a lot of money.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, my. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
The man's body was found by 2 pheasant hunters 6 months later on November 27th, 1/2 mile west of the Western Pacific Yard. At the time, the county coroner reported that he had been killed by a large bloodstained rock found nearby and that he had been dead for approximately 6 months. He was never identified.
By the time this discovery was made, Gomez had killed 2 more men. On the afternoon of November 11, 1950, Gomez was visiting with a man named John Capusta inside John's shack in the hobo jungle on the banks of the American River near Sacramento when 43-year-old Warren Hood Cunningham spotted Gomez and charged at him, accusing him of stealing 2 cans of beer.
Gomez later told a reporter that Warren came at him with 2 pocket knives, quote, "I ran. Boy, how I ran. And he was still after me. I got away and I waited about 3 hours, I guess. I got mad. I got so mad I couldn't stop. I had a gun buried over by the American River and I went back to his place with it," unquote.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So the gun was a .22 caliber rifle. From the tree line 60 to 100 feet away, he spotted Warren Cunningham sitting by his shack with John Capusta. And the two were listening to a radio.
Gomez took aim, fired 3 shots, and watched as Cunningham fell over. He then approached Cunningham and shot him 3 more times.
Oh!
Yeah. Capusta, who was nearly blind, couldn't describe to police what the shooter looked like.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's convenient for Gomez.
Yeah.
So then Gomez went from the paradise of Sacramento to the paradise of Fresno, and then down to Los Angeles. On November 19th, 1950, Gomez ran into Earl Franklin Woods, 50 years old, near Mojave, which is between Fresno and LA, so that Central Valley area. And Gomez asked Earl for a light for his cigarette.
Earl said no. When he turned around, Gomez attacked him with a rock and beat him to death with it. Gomez found only 3 cigarettes in the dead man's shirt pocket. No money.
Wow.
Yeah.
So a few days after murdering Earl Woods and a few miles from Los Angeles, Gomez was arrested by Burbank City Police for vagrancy. He served 30 days, and before his arrest, he had dismantled his rifle and gotten rid of it. Can't catch me, coppers!
Released in late December, Gomez went for 6 months without killing anyone.
Hmm.
When he did start up again, he killed 6 men in 3 months.
Oh.
So, yeah, he went
I was going to say, you know, with any other thing, we would be so proud. You, wow,
yeah.
Good job. 6 months without X.
Killing anyone.
Yes. but it doesn't work in this scenario.
Doesn't feel right.
No.
No. No. On May 29th, 1951, Gomez found Elmer M. Cushman sitting on an open top rail car. He picked up a rock, approached him, and beat the man to death with the rock. He took $16.50. That doesn't sound like much, but using an inflation calculator, it amounts to about $200 in today's money.
That's enough for a couple nights in a hotel.
Few meals. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So 10 days later, Gomez found a man sleeping in the tall grass near the railroad tracks by Stockton. Gomez killed him with a rock and a wood plank. Oh, he added extra auxiliary items.
Yeah.
Searching through his pockets, he found $20, which is $244 in today's money, and this man was never identified.
On June 22nd, Gomez was picking peaches near Merced, California, when he spotted George Jones walking into the hobo camp there. The 60-year-old found a spot he liked and began cooking up some food.
Hmm.
Gomez snuck up behind him and broke his skull with a rock.
Oh!
Yeah. In the man's wallet, he found $24.50, which sounds like his biggest haul yet and amounts to about $300 in today's money.
Yeah. And you mentioned that it was three people in 3 months, but that's, you know, like enough to get by for presumably almost a month. You know, if you're in his circumstances, like it's enough for him to survive. I'm just reiterating the survival aspect of it. I'll get into it in my takes, but he's surviving in a very horrendous way at the expense of others is what I mean.
Right.
So on July 17th, Gomez dropped a 20-pound rock on the head of Arvid Ostlund near the railroad tracks leading out of Roseville. The 40-year-old only had $1 on him.
Oh, geez.
A 20-pound rock.
Wow.
That's too much. Wow.
How?
Yeah. Head scratch.
His eighth victim was an unidentified man he found sleeping in his underwear 100 yards from the railroad tracks near Marysville in early August 1951. He later said, quote, "I threw sand in his face and hit him with a brick," unquote. His life was worth 21 cents.
Wow. On August 16th, 46-year-old Roy Chester Hansen was minding his own business when Gomez found him sitting on a railroad car on the Southern Pacific tracks northeast of Sacramento. Hansen was his ninth and final victim. He couldn't even remember if the man had any money or not.
Mm.
We didn't get a lot of information about these victims,
right?
Mostly because of the time frame. But
yeah,
if you know anything about any of the names we mentioned, please let us know.
Let us know.
Yeah, yeah. Because they were people. Now we're going to get into the investigation and the arrest.
Hit it, Beth!
The murders did not go unnoticed. In June of 1951, two criminal investigators with the California State Department of Justice spotted the pattern. Although the classification of serial killer was more than 20 years away, they correctly assumed that they were looking for one man, a hobo, mm-hmm. who was killing other hobos with stones and wooden clubs.
Four hours ago, I found out the person that I'd been dating and seeing for the last 6 months as a con man.
That is my sister Emma. Andrew Tonks' lies had been so convincing, she'd invested $300,000 with him. However, the tables were about to turn on Andrew. What he didn't know was that Emma had discovered his real identity. But to get any chance of justice, Emma had to act like it was business as usual. Coming up in this series...
And that's when murder, all this stuff goes through my mind. I'm really, really scared.
I'm assuming Sarah has watched too much Netflix and figures I've been defrauding you. Couldn't be further from the truth.
That's what this was, a real-life story that seems so unbelievable, but it was actually true.
A true story that all starts with one simple swipe to the right. I'm Sarah Ferris.
And I'm Emma Ferris, and this is my story, Conning the Con.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande, the host of True Crime Psychology and Personality. On my podcast, I explore and explain the pathology behind some of the most horrendous crimes and those who commit them. We discuss topics like narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, and antisocial personality disorder from a scientifically informed perspective. What is a narcissist? How do you spot a sociopath? What signs can you look for to protect yourself from these dangerous personalities? It's not just about the stories, but also the science and psychology behind them. So if you're interested in true crime or mental health, I'd encourage you to give my show a listen wherever you get podcasts.
Shortly after Roy Hansen's body was found, they publicly announced their investigation, and several newspapers called it the Mystery of the Hobo Jungles. A captivating headline. 8 of the victims were found in camps along the railroad tracks with their heads smashed in. Robbery appeared to be the motive, and in each case, there were no witnesses.
Warren Hood Cunningham was the only victim in which a gun was used. He was also the only victim for which there were witnesses.
Gomez was picked up by city police after they found him wandering the streets, bleeding from a slash which ran from his left eye to the bridge of his nose. He was charged with vagrancy. After a week in jail, he sent a note to his jailer confessing to the murders of 9 men.
He said he killed the men because he had to eat and he needed money. He told investigators that life was, quote unquote, no good, and he didn't care what happened to him. He stated that he was better off dead and that he didn't want to live.
That's so sad to hear. And it kind of paints, a picture of, you know, why he continued to do what he did. He really didn't care.
Didn't give a shit anymore. Yeah.
So now we're going to get into the trial. So let me tell you, Gomez was tried for the murder of Warren Hood Cunningham. He was never tried for the other 8 murders. During the trial, he tried to escape, but was tackled by police and bystanders.
After 2.5 hours of deliberation, the jury came back with a guilty verdict. He was sentenced to death.
So now let's get into where are they now? Well, Gomez's last meal was fried chicken, fried potatoes, peas, tomato and lettuce salad, toast, apple pie, and coffee.
He was executed at 10:04 a.m. on October 16th, 1953. He spoke with a reporter the night before his execution. He said he wasn't scared.
I believe it was, quote, "I ain't scared."
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Is that right?
I think so. Yeah.
Fact checkers. So that's it for the story. We're going to tell you what we think in our hot takes and what we think made him snap. But if you have ideas, get at us or let us know if you agree or not. So here we go. What do you think, Beth?
I don't think this guy stood a chance.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
With his mom dying when he was young and his dad basically sucking as a parent.
Yes.
He was on his own by the time he was about 15, maybe even younger. I don't know.
Yeah.
And he barely had an education or any skills.
Right.
And so he went out into the world and it sucked.
Yeah. It was really hard.
It was really hard. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think he was worn out and angry at his lot in life.
Mm-hmm.
He said he didn't want to live anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And like you were saying, I'm sure that not valuing his own life might make one not value the lives of others either.
Absolutely.
But I also wonder if something happened to him at the infamous McNeil Island Federal Prison Penitentiary.
The super-sized prison?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's where he spent a year and before he went on his killing spree.
Yeah.
Like right after he got out, he started killing. So
that's a great point, Beth. I agree with everything you said. And, you know, we don't know a ton about his childhood, but we can kind of come to some reasonable conclusions or speculations. And one of the things I thought of is he was on his own very young and did not complete school and didn't have the necessary skills. And they said that he had the mind of a child.
Yeah.
One thing I know about children is they understand death or the value of human life. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so I wonder if his lack mentally may have contributed to his ability to continue harming people. You know, I know he was surviving and everybody around him was doing their best to survive, but his came at the expense of everybody else.
Right.
And that seems really selfish and almost childish. I can't think of a better word.
Right. No, I know what you're saying.
Yeah. So thank you. And his last days were really, really sad, but maybe it's what is deserved. I mean, justice is so complicated and, you know, without knowing what the survivors of the victims, you know, the victims' family members or relatives, what they wanted for their loved ones or wanted to see the person who took their loved ones away happen to them.
As far as justice
As far as justice, yeah. I mean, again, it's complicated, but I think some would argue that it is what he deserved because nobody visited him. Like, no, he didn't make any friends along the way.
Nope.
Nobody wrote him any letters. Like,
yeah.
And it's crazy how, you know, same shit, different day. Poverty is a crime again.
Yeah.
And, you know, crime increases as poverty increases. And big cities like New York are like, let's just throw more cops, bring in the National Guard. Like, it's not helping.
Yeah.
So when are we going to learn?
Helping the poor people. Yeah.
Come on, guys. So to this day, it's an issue. And, you know, even most liberal folks would be like, we need to do something about that problem, that poverty problem, that homelessness problem. And when you say, okay, well, how about affordable housing, like not too far up the street from you? Oh, no.
No, not in my backyard.
We meant over there somewhere else.
Somebody else's problem.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So we kind of have to reimagine how we look at like helping people, making the world better and safer for all of us.
Yeah.
And again, let us know what you think. Now it's time to talk about how not to get murdered.
All right.
If you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you. She's back.
I'm back. This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's experiences.
So I've been watching a lot of self-defense videos and I'm watching them and like trying to move my body while watching, like trying to get the moves down. I couldn't explain to you how to do it over with this is an audio medium, not video. So I'm just going to direct you to one that I've found lately. It's at Las Vegas Combat Academy. And it's an urban combat system. And it's run by a black guy. And he's like this hardcore like coach, like does motivational talks and stuff. I don't listen to that part, but I watch the videos over and over and over again. And what he does is help people survive the unthinkable. He always says, is this 100%? No, but it's better than nothing and it'll give you a chance. So there's this one particular, so go follow them. But there's one particular video I've been watching over and over again, and it's about how to get out of a chokehold. Again, couldn't tell you how to do it. But again, he's honest about improving your chances of survival. So follow at Las Vegas Combat Academy on Instagram.
Awesome.
Do you have any?
No, I don't.
Okay. All right. Well, then let's move on over a couple steps down the way to the shout out portion of our show where we shout out any content by people of color or about people of color or by any minoritized or marginalized folks or about them and any true crime goodies. So I'm so excited about this. It's a podcast called Mother Knows Death.
Ooh.
Have you heard of it?
I have not.
So I love Blood and Guts.
Yes.
And one of the hosts is somebody I follow on Instagram. She's a pathology assistant and she posts medical cases. So really gross stuff like gross diseases and gross limbs and postmortem findings and things like that. And she's educating people on pathology and death and forensic science. And now she has a podcast. And gosh, the last episode was about torture and the origins of torture in like the 15th, 16th centuries and what they would do to people's bodies. Then today's episode was about a dude who wasn't circumcised and like, what is it called? There's a really gross term for the buildup of decades smegma. Of stuff under his smegma. How do you know that?
I just pulled it up.
That is the word. And oh, I was so excited to learn a new word. Anyway, Mother Knows Death. And it's one of my new favorite podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. So also, if you haven't heard the Beyonce album yet, Cowboy Carter, listen to it. It is so good. Not only is it good music, but there's a lot of history wrapped up into it. Like, did you know the song Blackbird, written by Sir Paul McCartney, is a tribute to black girls in the South who were during the civil rights struggle? Because I guess he says in England, a girl is called a bird. So Blackbird, fly. Yeah. And every song on the album has like two eyes in the title. And apparently it has to do when Beyonce's grandmother was born, they misspelled her last name. So Beyonce was spelled with two I's instead of an E. And they went back to the hospital and were like, hey, can you change this? And the hospital's like, no, you N-words are lucky enough that you got to give birth in this hospital, get a birth certificate at all. Get out of here. So wow. There's so much wrapped up into it. And it's great. What do you got?
Oh, I wanted to shout out a show on AMC Plus. It's called The Long Shadow.
Oh.
And it's about the Yorkshire Ripper in England.
Wait, there's another Ripper?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
This one was in the 70s, I believe.
What?
Yeah, 70s and 80s.
Did they find him?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
They got him.
It's not mysterious like Jack.
No. They did find him.
Okay.
But the story is about the victims. Like it's very victim centric. So the Yorkshire Ripper was Peter Sutcliffe. I just looked it up.
Oh.
And he killed mostly sex workers.
Okay.
Between 1975 and 1980.
Oh.
And yeah, so it's about the women and like the misogyny and like what they had to put up with. One of the ladies that was attacked, she wasn't murdered, but she was hit in the head and she was Black.
Uh-huh.
And they just treated her like crap. Like,
is it documentary style or scripted?
No, it's scripted.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really good.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Yeah.
Okay, so just to recap, Mother Knows Death, a podcast wherever you get your podcasts, Cowboy Carter, wherever you get your music or streaming services, and The Long Shadow on AMC Plus about the Yorkshire Ripper in England. Oh, look at that. It's the end of the show.
It's the end of the show.
But it's just for now. We'll see you soon. Beth, where can the people find us in the meantime?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all of our social media. The footnotes for each episode can be found on our website. Plus, check it out for the different ways that you can support the show. Also, join us on Patreon, where we have literally hundreds of hours of bonus content. You can also support us by supporting our sponsors or by giving us a 5-star review.
Five stars only, please.
Also, don't forget to subscribe.
That's right. Now listen close, y'all. This is a weekly podcast and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, y'all. It's crazy out there. She's back.
I'm back. Skilling spree.
Colloquially.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Colloquially.
Sorry. You caught me at gummy o'clock.
Gummy o'clock.
Sorry.
No, that was a good one.
Thanks. Hey, you know, I saw a really funny meme that the United States is just a multi-level marketing scheme. Think about it.
Is, yeah.
Think about it.
Spotted.
Oh.
Spotted. Spotted the pattern. Spotted the pattern. I don't know what I think.
We're tired. It's sleepy time. All right, well, let's get back to the story. Remind us, Beth. Yeah. Did you forget we do a podcast?
Having so much fun over the break.
Oh, my goodness.
Sorry. There's that damn frog again.
Oh, rebuke thee.
Extending from the yeast. Oh, my God.
Whoa,
sorry.
Whoa, friend, take a breath. Is it even my turn? I'm totally lost. Okay.
Yep.
So at the same time, the Atlanta child murders.
Moiters.
A moiter.
Moiters.
Godzilla. Whoa.
Whoa, no. They say he's got to go. Go,
Godzilla. Yeah.
Blue Oyster Cult. That was my jam back in the day.
Wait, really?
Yeah, I loved Blue Oyster Cult.
I thought you would recognize that. I just had a feeling deep down
that
inside.
That was my jam.
Oh, man. I've only heard it in commercials.
They did Don't Fear the Reaper, too.
What?
You never heard that one?
No, but I'm going to like it.
Baby, don't fear the reaper, the wind, the sun, or the rain.
No! Okay.
Don't fear the reaper.
Oh, my God! Oh, yeah!
That's Blue Oyster Cult.
Okay, I'm going to brush my teeth to that song this evening. Woo! Get crazy. All right. Did you ever see them in concert?
I did. Yeah, a couple of times.
No way. Did Minnie go with you?
Yeah.
That's so cool. Oh, wow. Okay, well, that is so exciting. All right.
I want to take a moment to tell you about my podcast, Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage. In 1984, a woman named Phyllis Cottle was abducted in broad daylight, tortured, and left to die in a burning car in Akron, Ohio. At the time, I was a rookie reporter covering this horrific story. Since then, I've reported every kind of crime imaginable. I've been able to leave most of them at work, but not this one. The one that buried itself under my skin and stayed put. Phyllis Cottle was a badass woman, and I want to tell you her story. A production of Evergreen Podcasts and signature title of the Killer Podcast Network, you can find Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage wherever you get your podcasts. Discover more great true crime and paranormal programming at killerpodcast.com.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Paul Brandis introducing my podcast, Countdown to Dallas. It's a fascinating, in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's based on my book of the same title. In that book and in this podcast, I go all the way back to 1939, when Lee Harvey Oswald was born into a troubled and dysfunctional family. I'll follow his transient and often violent teenage years and young adulthood, painting a fuller picture of the man who would later become Kennedy's killer. I also take a look at events unfolding in that era, like Cuba and Vietnam, and I'll unpack the conspiracy theories too, not one of which has ever been conclusively proven. Subscribe to Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or your favorite listening app, October 31st.